the tuning at low power and that last little bit of touch-up at the high power level and try to keep it as brief as possible, knowing that unless the band is really dead, you're creating interference with somebody. And if they know who you are, they would be very unhappy with you. So the whole perfect tune-up procedure is a little bit of a compromise as I see it. Want to go to one more, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, I tell you what, let's leave it fixed because it's not fair. The kids got to go to sleep. Young people got to go to sleep. Tomorrow's regular school day, so I don't want to get in bed with parents over.
Okay, the next person on our list was Bill, and after that we're going to go over to Howie. N2 Echo Oscar. Now, Bill, if you're still there, if we haven't put you to sleep, go right ahead with your question or comment. K2RIW in the TechNet. Okay, looks like Bill wasn't able to hang in there. Howie, go ahead with your question. K2RIW in the TechNet.
And I got a question for you afterwards.
Okay, Eric, you're on the list. Go ahead, Howie. Maybe Howie's not available right now, so go right ahead, Eric.
Don't forget me, Dick.
Yeah, we're going to come back to you guys. Go ahead, Eric.
I never ran across something interesting, and I'm trying to figure it out. Maybe you can point me to where I can find the formula that I need. Basically, what I'm looking to do is I want to plot the far field pattern for an array that's uniformly spaced, okay? And somewhere in my brain, I seem to remember the energy pattern produced by that kind of array is going to be phase-dependent, is going to be a phase-dependent summation of the individual field pattern. And there was a term for the group behavior. It was called something factor. I think it was like an array factor. Does that ring any bells to you?
It sure does, Eric. Every phased array antenna, and what I mean by phased array is an antenna that has more than one feed point in the actual radiating element. Or you could say more than one radiating element. If you really want to be logical, a Yagi antenna is a phased array. Sometimes it's called a Yagi array. So whenever you've got more than one element that's doing the radiating of an antenna, and it is placed in some manner in space, so that each one has a so-called address or phase center, and you're feeding some amount of power to each one of those elements, and at some amount of phase angle to each one of those elements. The universal law is that the total antenna pattern is the product of the array pattern and the element pattern. Assuming you've got a step and repeat number of identical elements, and you took one single element all by itself and measured its pattern on an antenna range, that is the element pattern. Then once you know the address in wavelength of spacing horizontally and vertically of all of those elements, there is a reasonable formula. It's got some sines and cosines in it. It's got a numerator and a denominator, which allows you to predict the array pattern. And the final pattern is always the voltage product. If you knew at each angle in space what is the element pattern, and at that angle in space you know the array pattern, and you multiply, once you normalize them, you multiply one toward the other, one against the other, that is the total pattern. So all phased arrays obey that set of rules. The next step of the, let me drop, if you really want to get elaborate now, and that's where you're feeding different amounts of power, call it voltage, and different amounts of phase angle to each of the elements, now you're getting into what's called the Widrow algorithm, W-I-D-R-O-W. Mr. Widrow, way back in the late 60s, wrote a couple of very pivotal articles in Antennas and Propagation, which allows you to really predict what's going on, not predict from what you're going to get, but predict what you should be feeding to all the elements to get what you desire. Let me give you a crazy example of this. I know this is a little bit beyond what you desire, but still, it's good information. You're going to put it in the back of your head. Let me drop. Let's say that I've got a antenna that's 4 wide and 4 high. It's got a total of 16 radiating elements. Sort of a bed spring, a collinear antenna. Believe it or not, if I've got enough adaptability in the way that I feed power to those elements and the phase angle that I feed to those elements, with a total of 4x4, 16 elements, the laws of physics will allow you to steer 1 minus the number of elements. 16 elements, 1 minus the 15. I can simultaneously steer 15 peaks somewhere in space. I can simultaneously, at the same time, steer 15 nulls somewhere in space. The only real restriction is that a peak and a null cannot be co-located. If I had 15 desirable emitters out there from my satellite looking down at the Earth, and they're all scattered across the whole darn United States, I got 15 desirable signals, and I got 15 undesirable signals, jammers, with a 16-element array and the Widjo algorithm mathematics. I can set that thing up so that at one fixed setting, at each one of those frequencies, it'll listen to the 15 desirable guys and peek up on them all at once, with a slight compromise, of course, get into that in a minute, and null out each of the 15 jammers and do that all at once. Is that a powerful set of rules? Without a doubt. I will admit that the Widjo algorithm gets into matrix mathematics. It's pretty heavy stuff, but just know it's there.
Doesn't bother me.
Glad to hear it. KE2EJ. And you go to the right computer program, it'll give you the answer pretty fast. You got it, Eric. K2RIW.
Oh, it looks like I have a little reading to do. So in other words, I could say, now I'm going to assume that because we're really talking the radiation pattern from, let's say, a single antenna, on a single plane, we're really only going to be talking about an elevation of 0 degrees at this point. And with the Widjo algorithm, as I add to it, then it becomes more a three-dimensional type of thing where the matrix arithmetic is going to be important. And 0 degrees elevation is really perpendicular to the direction of the antenna. So Woodrow is going to bring in the additional factors that I need beyond the number of elements, the spacing, the frequency, and the progressive phase shift between each element. Is that correct?
Yes, it is. But let's go now to something more simple. I'm making a simple vertical collinear antenna. Something like a station master. Let's assume the elements are four high, four half-wave dipoles vertically stacked. Each individual dipole has potentially 2.14 dB of gain, and a particular pattern that's very well known. And I really now care about what's going to happen 20 degrees above the horizon. 20 degrees from boresight of each dipole, the gain has fallen off, let me pick a number, 0.03 dB, something damn small. That is the element pattern. The array pattern, because there are four of them, has potentially 6 decibels of gain, and 20 degrees above the horizon, because my array pattern looks like a sine x over x, I peaked it up on the horizon, and I look 20 degrees above the horizon, I'm slotting the crawl down the side of the skirt of that first main lobe of the sine x over x, and I'm 5 dB down. So, in that particular case, when I take the product of the two in voltage, which really is adding decibels, I'm 5 dB down because of the array pattern, I'm 0.03 dB down because of the element pattern, I'm 5.03 dB down above the horizon. That's a real example. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
I gotcha. That's making sense to me. So, what I gotta do is I gotta find a good book on this, but I'm now beginning to think that really what I've got is a summation of the cosines of the different angles that are involved. And to get more complex, I'd then plot that in a 3x3 matrix, yeah?
You got it. If you wanted to set up your own program to do it, not go to somebody else's canned program, you literally calculate. You know what power and what voltage, what phase angle you're feeding to each element. You stand off at an infinite distance at the particular angle you care about. And you calculate how much signal gets there from an antenna from radiator number one, how much signal gets there from radiator number two, and so on. You go down the list. You figure out the amplitude of what gets to you at your point of observation and the phase angle. Now by some relatively simple trigonometry, you add those particular phase angles. Yes, you're taking the cosine of the phase angle to figure out the way they add. And by the way, you're going to be taking sine and cosine. You've got an in-phase and an out-of-phase component. And so at your fixed point in space, you're going to add up the voltage contribution as a vector, amplitude and phase, of each one of the signals coming from each one of the individual elements. Assume each element is an individual experiment. You just happen to be doing the experiment four times in a row all at once. There's a slight catch to what I just said. In the real world, some of the signal from element number one does feed into element number two, and some cross-coupling involved. Unfortunately, life gets a little bit complicated. But with a good design antenna with proper spacing, that tends to be a second-order effect. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
I got you. So if I wanted to plot this, I would basically take, let's call the sine the x-coordinate and the cosine the y-coordinate, and I can actually take those individual elements and those calculations and plot them as a plot, yeah?
You got it. Way back in 1978, when there were no CAN programs available, I literally did all this on a Hewlett-Packard 9825 old-fashioned desktop calculator. And it took me, I think, something like 10 or 15 magnetic tape cartridges to contain all the data. And to plot it on an XY plotter took something like 20 minutes, and it would wear out a felt tip pen, so I had to modify the plotter so it would take a rapidograph pen, which wouldn't wear out. But when you look at my red QSL card, made in 1978, on the back of that card you will see the three-dimensional antenna pattern of my array of 16 Yagis of 19 elements H. A 304 element array, the three-dimensional antenna pattern, is on the back of my QSL card. It was plotted by that exact technique you just described on that old-fashioned computer way back in 1978. K2EJ, K2RIW.
Yeah, K2RIW, K2EJ. Yeah, okay. I mean, if I really wanted to get, I could probably use, MATLAB or MathCAD. I mean, I could also use Excel. I ain't going to do it by him, that's for sure. But, and of course, it's going to be the number of steps. The more steps, of course, the more calculations. But the computer can do a fine job of that. I got a little more reading to do, and maybe I'll take a crack at this. Thanks. I just wanted to confirm my thinking. K2RW, K2J.
Yeah, I guarantee, Eric, you're going to enjoy it. It's a little bit rough in the beginning to set up the equations correctly. And make yourself a couple of simple diagrams and run it through your program to make sure the answers you're getting are not crazy. And by the way, when it comes to setting up matrices, which really means you've got a horizontal row and a vertical column of numbers, and depending on the way you set up the machine to be either column major or row major, you get that backwards, as I did on a couple of the plots I made. Wow, do you get a funny looking plot. The plot I got, I wish I could find it and show it to you. I call it a Frumious Bandersnatch. It's the spikiest looking antenna pattern in the world. Absolutely impossible. Mother Nature, the laws of physics would never let you really do it. But you mix up the column major and the row major in the way you recorded the data and then play it back to the plotting program. Boy, you get something that's really out of this world. But it's fun stuff. You'll enjoy it. John, Casey took...
Now, one last thing.
Go ahead, Eric.
If I'm going to be, really, it's going to be expressed in dB, so in essence, each element is going to be 20 times the log of the result of the calculation, yeah?
Absolutely. Bear in mind that all antenna patterns, all multipath situations, everything in Mother Nature's world is voltage. You and I, as engineers, think in power, in watts. We think in decibels. Mother Nature absolutely, positively does not. Everything in the real world is adding up and subtracting vector voltages. So the real equation, the real calculations, the summing of the individual signal components must be in voltage. After you sum those voltages, convert it to decibels if you like. If you do it in decibels first, you're going to run into some problems because when you get negative and positive decibels because the signal is less than unity and greater than unity, oh boy, you're going to get all kinds of troubles. Yeah, well, you don't get negative decibels, really.
Oh?
If you're writing in dBm, you're definitely going to get negative decibels. And your antenna pattern is reference to something, reference to unity. There are portions of the antenna pattern where you've got a deep no. In the decibel world, it's definitely negative decibels, in my opinion. Over to you, Eric.
I'm not thinking involved in power. Right. Okay. But we're zero.
When you're plotting an antenna pattern, everything is referenced usually to the bore site. Right at the bore site of the antenna where everything adds up in a co-phase manner, usually, if you're not doing something exotic on the antenna, you call that unity and everything is less than that. But still, my recommendation is you set the equations in a voltage manner and at the very end, convert it to decibels if that's the way you want to plot it. And when you do plot it in decibels, if it's a polar plot, you've got another great big set of decisions to make. The outside of the polar plot is the unity, the bore site. The center of the polar plot, you can make that point 20 dB down, 30 dB down, 40 dB down, depending on how many lines you put between the perimeter and the center of your polar plot. You'll get a very different looking antenna pattern as you just simply change that parameter of the plotting program. So you're going to have a lot of fun with this. Thank you, Eric.
All right. I see it. And I can do that for 0 degrees elevation and continue all the way up to 180 degrees and really make myself nuts.
And in certain situations, that's a very valid thing to do. By way of the MATLAB and other programs, they will give you a three-dimensional plot where they not only plot the peaks and valleys of the mountains on the sphere, so to speak, but they also change them in color. And many antenna patterns really look like a bumpy apple because red is usually the reference point, and the null points are dark blue or black or something like that. So it's a bumpy apple plot is what you're going to get on many very simple antennas like the ones you've got on a cell phone. You'd be amazed how many people think you can really steer the antenna pattern on a cell phone. No way in hell. Because everybody wants the antenna to be internal to that cell phone that's in your hand. And you have essentially no real estate to work with. You have none of the resources that are required to really steer that antenna pattern. You go down that list that's published on one of the websites, which tells you the specific absorption rate, the amount of radio frequency biohazards, so to speak, of each one of the brands and model numbers of cell phones, and you list 100 of them or more, and you think you're going to buy the one with the least amount of specific absorption rate, and you think you're buying the safest cell phone, you think you're buying the one with the greatest antenna pattern. You believe that, and I'm going to sell you a bridge in Brooklyn. I own part of it. What's really going on, the lower SAR cell phone is the lower power output cell phone. Period. And if you buy and use a lower power cell phone, you're going to have more dropouts on the uplink between you and the cell site. Can't have it any other way. And you can go out and buy this little sticker that you put on the cell phone that claims it's going to direct all the RF energy away from your head and out into the world. You buy that, and I'll sell you the other half of my of the bridge I own in Brooklyn. No way in hell. When you're operating at those frequencies, the low frequencies, for instance, of a cell phone,
repeater, timeout, cancel.
The lowest frequency is around 800 megs, where the wavelength is in the vicinity of 14 inches is the wavelength, and the whole damn cell phone in your hand is about 4 inches or 5 inches high. You think you're going to make an antenna pattern out of that? No way. You think you're going to control that antenna pattern by putting a little piece of a sticker on there? No way. You pay your money, you take your choice.
No, I miss the old cell phones that had an antenna connector.
I know. And with a real antenna connector, you could run a coaxial cable to a mag mount on the roof of the car, and you're going to get five times the range, so to speak. But we don't think RF. I'm amazed that people will take a cell phone and go driving off into the wilderness, like there's a buddy I know who just loves having a wilderness experience. So once every year for about 2 weeks, he goes to northern Canada to where civilization ends. He puts on his backpack, and he starts walking for a couple of days into the outback, into the tundra. And in those days, he wasn't carrying a cell phone. Nowadays, he will carry a cell phone. He's not smart enough to know to carry some extra batteries. He's got no way of charging the damn thing. And he doesn't even bother plotting where are the cell sites where he could possibly holler Mayday if he gets into trouble. How many people do you know? I mean, we amateur radio operators, if we're going to a New York City marathon, and you're doing it with a handy talkie, you've got a couple of extra batteries in your pocket and a plastic strip across the battery to make sure it doesn't make a short circuit with your change and your keys and create a fire in your pocket. But you carry a couple of extra batteries. Nobody, as a cell phone operator, carries an extra battery. Half of the people don't even have a way of charging it from their automobile.
Oh, that's not true.
Okay. How many people do you know with a cell phone carry an extra battery?
Well, okay, all the people that I send out to do jobs in the middle of nowhere, but then again, they're carrying a satellite phone, so, you know, there are some people that think ahead, and I carry an extra cell phone battery from, actually, I plug in, I have a little solar-powered charger, and so does Janine, so we're in good shape.
Yeah, but you are an engineer. Of your non-engineering friends, how many of them carry a battery, an extra battery for their cell phone?
I got to admit that all my friends have this little solar gizmo, so if there's sunlight, they got batteries.
Because they talk to you. They've been contaminated. Okay. That's not a real objective survey we just did here, Eric. John, sorry we kept you waiting so long. KC2WGV, you got the floor.
KGRIW2YO.
Bernie recognized, but John first. Go ahead, John.
Thank you, Dick. That's all right. I'm here for the whole duration anyway. I have a quick question. I'd like your opinion on what do you think is going to happen, if anything, when I submerge my permanent magnet in my liquid nitrogen tank, which should take it down to, I believe, 240 degrees negative. Do you have any idea if I would be able to measure any difference before I do this?
It's going to kill us. I don't think so. When you go up in temperature, almost every magnetic material has something called the Curie temperature. And at the Curie temperature, you're shaking the molecules so violently that they decide they're not going to stay in their alignment anymore, and you lose the majority of your magnetic properties of a permanent magnet when you go up in temperature. When you go down in temperature, I think most magnets, other than a physical mechanical stressing problem, in other words, the way your magnet...
That's what I was mentioning.
The way your magnet was constructed, you may run into a fracture problem depending on how you do the cooling. I mean, when I'm cryogenically cooling the focal plane array of my charge-coupled device on my super camera because I want to really get a very low dark current because I'm going to make astrophotography and I want to integrate for an hour, the way I cool it makes a big difference. You better do it slowly. You cool something rapidly where half of it is at the minus 200 centigrade and the other half is still at zero centigrade, and you're making thermal stresses up the kazoo and you're going to crack the living daylights out of it. So, if your magnet is made out of the right material and you cool it slow enough, I think it's possible to get it down to 3 degrees Kelvin, liquid helium temperature, and still keep the magnetic field with very little change to it other than the change created by the physical shrinking of the thermal expansion rate of your particular materials. So how fast you do it, I think, is the biggest variable, in my opinion. Over to you, John.
Yes, I've learned to cool things slowly because I have broken a few items. This is a very well-made permanent magnet, and I just didn't want to waste the helium, before I made this test if it was going to be worthless, because I'm going to see if the magnetic field decreases, or maybe I can find a way to see if its pattern changes. That I haven't figured out yet, but that's basically what I was doing. But I thank you for your input.
Comment.
Yeah, hold on a minute, Wesley. Man, you just said a word, helium. I wonder if you meant liquid nitrogen. Liquid nitrogen, 73, I think it is, degrees Kelvin, is something very affordable. At every point in time, a buddy of mine once came up with a theory, which is reasonably true. At every point in time, liquid nitrogen is approximately the price of milk. Liquid helium is approximately the price of the best champagne you can buy. So, and anybody who's using liquid helium recognizes the fact that it has an extremely low thermal specific heat. Therefore, nobody, unless he's a real rich man, will cool something directly with liquid helium. He first has an outer doer with liquid nitrogen, and then an inner doer with liquid helium, and he tries to use as little of it as possible because the stuff is damn expensive. Are you really using liquid helium? Have you guys gone that far, John? Wow. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I have used liquid helium. I meant liquid nitrogen. I thought that's what I said. But no, that's exactly what you do. You bring it down with nitrogen first, then you induce helium. But I won't be using helium on the magnet. You're right. It's too expensive, and I only have like a half a pee bottle left of that. But it is expensive. Back to you, Dick.
Go ahead, Wesley.
Hendrix here. Well, John, we're going to do this experiment. I'm going to bring you the 912 golf meters that I have from RFL, and I'll be very interesting what are the results. I believe this device is quite made for it. The only thing is that I'm going to ask Dick, this golf meter has a number of probes. And I understand that these probes have to be in the vicinity of this material. They might simply get damaged. Do you have any knowledge in this area? Back to you.
Okay, in the case of Hall effect type of Gauss meter probe, which is one of the popular kind, Hall effect, I don't know. You're going to have to find out from the manufacturer of the Hall effect what thermal range over which it's rated for. In the case of a magnet, I believe the magnet is going to continue doing almost the same thing as you're cryogenically cooling. But the Hall effect device, does its calibration curve change as a function of temperature, is the first thing I'm worrying about. The second thing I'm worrying about is whether or not it is possible to damage a Hall effect device with temperature. I think that's going to have to be supplied to you by the manufacturer. If anyone else on frequency has experience with Hall effect versus crazy temperatures, give us your call letters right now. K2RIW on the TechNet.
Those probes, Dick, will be used as an exoprobe, so that won't be a concern.
No, but just maybe on. We use Hall effects at low temperatures, and some of them don't work well.
Okay, XBR, I think it was. Give us your full call letters and name first, sir. Go ahead.
No, K2YO.
Okay, yeah. Bernie, go ahead.
Good evening, Dick. No, my comment was back when you were asking about people carrying cell phones and chargers. I had a comment on that, that most people that have iPhones do carry charging cables with them because those things are terribly power hungry. So, yeah, I think most people do have charging cables or car chargers. But anyway, we've moved on. K2YO clear.
Good information, Bernie. Glad you gave it to us. So, Eric, you have personal experience with... I know that these guys are going to keep the Hall effect device outside of the cryostat, and hopefully the cryostat is made out of stainless steel, which is somewhat magnetically transparent. Therefore, on the outside, I think they can make these measurements. So, Eric, you've got experience with Hall effects at crazy temperatures, and you've had failures. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Yeah, we've had some VTRs in places that are below zero, and what I've discovered, I have different kinds of servo problems, and the Hall effect devices are used for as position indicators, and some of them stop working at low temperatures. The other thing is, when I bring it back into the shop, if I hit it with freeze spray, which is about minus 20 degrees, they don't like to work too well, and in a lot of cases, they don't work at all. As soon as you bring them up near zero, they start working again. And that's been my experience. And it's been pretty consistent. I mean, these are manufactured by a number of Japanese manufacturers, and also I think one was in a Texas Instrument, and another one was a Panasonic. You know, the typical kinds of things. I mean, even the VTR manufacturers tell you that you don't want to be in sub-zero temperatures with their devices.
KC2QIQ with a comment.
Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, I think with the Hall effect, Dick, and I think it's really pretty much true as it is with most electronics in cold temperature. You know, you have typically, you know, three grades. You know, you've got the commercial grade, which is good to things close to zero. You have an industrial grade that's usually good to minus 20, and then you have a lot of military grades And today, I guess with the industrial and the military, that's kind of getting mixed now. So there's a lot of manufacturers in the real heavy-duty industrial that are actually focusing on minus 40. But here again, you know, it's all of the electronics now that that you have to watch out for. But when you know, the amount of equipment that actually operates below minus 40 is really far and few between. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
This reminds me of the early days when I was watching satellite television, when I first got my TVRO. One of my TVRO may be the one that's the greatest number of feet above ground, at 60 feet above ground, on my tower, in order to clear the trees, and so I could see the most number of satellites. And when I used to watch CBC North, the Canadian Broadcasting System North, and it was real fun to watch them, you're watching the Inuk programming, what you and I call Eskimo, so to speak. And they give you the weather report for Tuktoyaktuk, which is one of the really northern towns in northern Canada. And whenever you get below zero here, we say, oh, 20 degrees below zero. And to us it means a lot. And to them they just call it minus 20. I remember hearing a couple of the weather reports in the dead of winter where they said the temperatures tonight will be minus 60, warming up to minus 40 tomorrow.
Well, that's in Celsius.
Exactly. And those, by my standards, are life-threatening temperatures. Can you imagine operating a reciprocal internal combustion-type engines and other things like Hall effect devices and your vacuum tube voltmeter or your digital voltmeter? Can you imagine any of the things that we all use, running them at minus 60 and minus 40? And they get temperatures like this in the Antarctic also at McMurdo Station. A buddy of mine is down there, and he tells me about some of the things they run into. Wow. You don't know what cold is like until you've lived in an environment like that. And it just rolls off the tongue so easily. Minus 60, warming up to minus 40 at high noon tomorrow.
We're in Yellowknife. And KC2QAQ with one more comment.
As I said, that was in Tuktoyaktuk. Go ahead, Glenn first. Glenn?
Yeah, but, you know, keep in mind, too, with areas like that, there's ways of cheating all around those kinds of things on the ratings. Like you could probably get a military product that's very good, or a really, really heavy duty industrial product that is rated either at minus 40 or very close to it. But here again too, a lot of these products, those are startup ratings, meaning that, you know, when something is off and it's cold and you have to turn it on, it's got to turn on, and that's a very, very difficult thing to do. But what's interesting is that a lot of times once something is operating and it's running and it's, you know, just developing its own inefficiencies and heat internally, can operate very surprisingly at temperatures, ambient temperatures, before. You know, but there again, when you start getting down to like minus 60, it really becomes a stretch. KC2QIQ.
Comment, Dick?
Okay, yeah. Wesley and then John ran over. Go ahead, Wesley.
Well, they're talking about Canada and the rest of the world. One thing is important. Are you referring to Celsius or Fahrenheit? Because the temperature below 20 below zero, or so minus 20, in this exactly wording, minus 20, is related to Celsius. And Poland, in Russia, it's a big ball. It's normal temperature. It's happening very often every winter time. So that's a small comment in this area. Back to you.
Celsius and Fahrenheit meet at minus 40, you know.
Exactly. So when you're at minus 40 centigrade and minus 40 Fahrenheit, they're exactly the same temperature. But yes, most of Canada uses the Celsius temperature scale. So minus 60 was minus 60. Go ahead, John.
Thank you. Thank you.
Dick, you'll enjoy this. Friends of mine who were down in Antarctica for the IGY, they had deuce and a half military trucks down there, and they couldn't even use antifreeze because it would freeze at 60 or 70 degrees below zero. So they ran them with no coolant in it at all, 24 hours a day, never shut them off. It was amazing. And he has pictures and all these things about when they tore the engines down, and it was normal wear. It was amazing.
Hey, Dick.
Yeah, go ahead, Derek.
Is Mel still with us?
I bet you he is. K2KUI, go right ahead.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Yeah, Mel, take a listen to your input and tell us if you hear anything. Just let us know.
Roger.
Yeah, if anybody could listen to the input and find out who, where is this guy.
Yep, got him here. Not too strong, but I'll rotate the beam. I'll give you a direction.
Thanks.
Okay.
S2 here.
A buddy of mine, I forget what his title was, but he was in the Air Force, stationed in Alaska. And I remember when he arrived, they guaranteed that he would have a nice warm situation in the wintertime. Instead of winter, I think he was close to Point Barrow, where it was, you know, dark 24 hours a day. And he got into the bus that they were supplying to him, and the thing was really cold. And he started complaining about the fact that, hey, you guys promised that everything would be all warmed up when I got here. To which they said, I forget what his title was. I'm going to call him Sergeant. Hey, Sergeant, we've been running this for 24 hours. We've never turned it off. The heater is on full blast. Yeah, the internal temperature in here is 0 degrees Fahrenheit. This is all you can get out of it. This is it. So some of the things that people have to put up in the Arctic are really something else. A buddy of mine was stationed in South Pole for a couple of years, and he showed us some of the photographs of what it's like to live there, and it describes some of the funny situations. You got to be real careful that everybody knows where you're going when you go outside, so they know if you're missing for a while to know to start looking for you. You might have fallen into a crevasse, or to do a bathroom operation outdoors. You'd be amazed how difficult that is in cold weather like that. But he describes the main thing that he misses down there is anything really green. There's nothing that grows, nothing is green, except for that sickening green paint that they use on many of their buildings. There's nothing that's really green. Everything is white or black. So it's a very different environment. And with any further questions or comments on all of the above, give me a call. It's K2RIW. Okay, yep.
Yeah.
You got it, Wesley?
Yeah, John was showing me a little experiment with the new magnet motor and a magnet. I'm sorry. Using a magnet and a ferrite. So if John can pick up and describe it to you.
You got it, John.
First, a comment for Eric. Eric, I had him at an S7 here in Staten Island.
Okay, and Mel?
S5 with, well, the beam is facing right at the Limark repeater site. So if it comes on again, I can get this beam around fairly sharp and give you a better definition of the direction of Eric over.
All right, anybody else got any reports?
But the guy is really scared right now, so, you know, into exchange. I'm looking for a few guys with directional antennas, and I want to really finish this guy and bring him to justice. And I'm willing to invest my money also if that is needed for bringing this guy to the justice and to exchange.
KC2QIQ.
Okay, we're going to go to Glenn and then John in that order. Go ahead, Glenn.
I'm getting a bearing here from Aspico, which is a little bit north and west, at you know, pretty strong S8 signal, which puts them somewhere between, say, Wausau Parkway, definitely west of the sea, but Oyster Bay, between there and, say, the Limark site, KC2QIQ.
What kind of signal strength?
It's varying around a little bit. It sounds like he's mobile, moving around a bit.
Yeah, but how hard is he hitting your meter?
7 to 9, fluctuating.
Okay, thanks.
I'm wondering what is your what are you doing with cryogenically cooling a neodymium magnet, John? If you want to tell us, KC2QI. Here we go. KC2WGV. K2RIW in the TechNet.
No, Dick, it's going to be an Alnico magnet, a very large Alnico magnet. I wouldn't put my neodymiums under that stress yet. I've had them crack from just making contact with each other from a distance. talking about. But what Wesley was referring to before, the new ferrites that he ordered, the large ones, which are approximately 5 inches in diameter, these neodymium magnets stick to them very strongly, and you can just about pull it off very strong. But I had a question, and I know Wesley's interested also. How do you go about actually measuring permeability of a substance? What is the sequence?
I think Glenn's going to have to answer that one for us. Glenn, how do they measure permeability? By the way, Glenn, I followed your advice. I went to Magnetic Inc. that you recommended we go to that website last week. And I went to a number of their sites where they give you descriptions of their toroidal and other shapes of ferrite and powdered iron and whatever material. Lots of good information there. And they had sort of a description of permeability. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
Yeah, very good, Dick. Unfortunately, I have to... John, can you please repeat the question?
Yeah, John was asking, how do you measure permeability of materials?
The simplest way that I do it is by using a simple equation called N squared times A sub L is equal to inductance. So a lot of times I'll do it as an inductance measurement. So basically what A sub L is the inductance at 1,000 turns. So basically you can basically determine the permeability of a material by knowing its, cross-sectional area, its path length, and then using that equation, you can tell the permeability of the material from its inductance, KC2QIQ.
Comment.
Yeah, I do remember seeing that on some of the Magnetic Inc.'s websites. So, Glenn, do you literally wind 1,000 turns onto your unknown material after you measure its cross-section and its path length, magnetic path length? Do you literally wind 1,000 turns, or maybe a smaller number, and do you then put it into some kind of instrumentation that measures inductance in millihenries or henries at your particular favorite frequency? And my guess is the inductance and the permeability is a rather frequency-sensitive parameter. I wonder if that's true. Over to you, Glenn.
This is measuring toroids, by the way.
Okay, first of all, with the toroid, it's easy because the path length is given to you by whoever the manufacturer is, and you know what the cross-sectional area is. Now, all you have to do is make simply an inductance measurement. And you don't have to use 1,000 turns. I mean, you could if you wanted to, and then, A sub L is unity. So at that point, the inductance of 1,000 turns. So you know what your N squared, your A sub L is, and you can figure it out from there. But here again, the interesting thing from inductance basically is that you can use 100 turns and then just plug it back into the equation because L is measured. You know what your turns are. They would be 100 squared. And now, basically, you can find out what your A sub L is. And then from the A sub L, you can directly determine through another equation what the permeability is.
Question.
Would I get much of a difference in the inductance if I wound 10 turns at the 12 o'clock position of my toroid as opposed to wrapping 100 turns and spacing them all the way around from 12 o'clock, 3 o'clock, 6 o'clock, 9 o'clock, back to 12. As I space those turns, would I make very much of a difference? I think the answer is almost no in the case of a toroid. Over to you, Glenn.
Well, the problem comes in with a little... What you're talking about is there's a thing called the Bollore effect, and that's basically as you move the... how uniform is the permeance around that core? And, is there going to be some ripple to it by either, squeezing the wire or moving it around? By going to a number of turns, like, say, between 10 to 100 turns, you take some of that variable out, KC2QIQ.
By the way, last week you were telling me about aluminum magnetic materials. On that Magnetic Inc. site, they talked about some of their materials which have a mixture and a small percentage of it is aluminum. But aluminum all by itself, I don't think is a magnetic material. But when it comes back to you, you'll get a chance to describe that some more. Wesley, go ahead.
Hey, Dixie. I have a 4194A impedance gain phase analyzer, and the advantage are 3754B network analyzer. Now, as far as I know, the Hewlett-Packard makes the fixture that I can plug into that, and it measures permeability. But a fixture costs $3,500 aftermarket used on eBay, and it's simply very very expensive. Now, do you have any idea how the fixture is being built? back to you, Glenn.
Yeah, I'm not convinced that you've got to buy that fixture. I think by wiring some turns and measuring inductance, I think you're going to get the 95% answer in accuracy, and I think that's good enough. What do you think, Glenn?
I think for most practical purposes, that's, you know, that's what the industry uses. You know, we go on inductance, and then just if you actually go onto that magnetic sink website, there's a group of equations there where you can calculate mu times the path length, the cross-sectional area, and you can solve for mu, and that's basically what you're doing. That's your initial permeability without current in the wire. So initial permeability is not a difficult thing to determine. It's basically just using that that right equation and then basically put a good fixed number of turns on there where you're getting a reliable, and when I say reliable inductance measurements, basically just, you know, squeezing and pushing the wire around and see that the inductance is pretty stable. If it isn't, just add a few more turns, and that usually takes out. But inductance by itself with the right equation will give you the permeability.
Glenn, is it possible that part of the expense of that fancy fixture is that it's simultaneously able to place some number of ampere turns of fixed magnetic field onto the material to measure the saturation mu? Is that part of what could be going on? Over to you, Glenn, first.
Well, inductance is a very good measurement for determining, as I said, mu sub zero or initial permeability. But, you know, it is mu sub I, which is, you know, here again, what's happening to that material as, you know, you start getting an offset of H field. So if there are offsets and other things like that, then a piece of equipment like that is much more valuable. Because, here again, dry inductance, where basically you have no offset, in other words, that material is just sitting there without any bias on it. All you're doing is measuring the inductance with a, you know, a low signal level inductance bridge. That's good enough for that measurement. But here again, now if you're putting a DC current in it and you're trying to measure inductance, it can be done, but it's much more difficult, and one of the meters that Wesley was talking about would be much more effective at that point.
Yeah, but you're talking inductance versus frequency. That means you guys not mentioning what frequency. Inductance in different frequency is different. And to extend.
Yeah, I'm guessing every material has a desired frequency range over which you get desirable performance. And as you test the inductance at various frequencies, I'm fairly sure you're going to get a different number. And as such, you're really measuring the frequency range over which the material is desirable. And I guess if you're using the right kind of instrumentation, you can literally be measuring the power factor. That gives you some hint as to what is the loss characteristic of your magnetic material at that particular frequency. Do they measure phase angle of inductance, which is really the equivalent of power factor? Back to you, Glenn.
Well, there, you know, there's all kinds of bridges that you can get to measure inductance. You can measure inductance with Q. You can measure it with its, the resistance of the wire. You can measure, you know, they're very, very fancy inductance bridges. I mean, it depends on how elaborate you want to get with that, but yeah, I mean, and you can get them to sweep. I mean, I've got a device here that will, you know, measure up to about 100 megahertz, so it's a very elaborate inductance bridge, but you know, when you start getting above 100 megahertz with inductance measurements, here again, I'm not so sure that, at that point, you're better off going by manufacturer's curves, I think, or using some kind of a specialized device that will measure the field externally and not go with inductance.
KC2OJO.
OJO recognized. Get to you in a second. The mechanism by which loss occurs, in other words, if I've got a ferrite material that's rated up to 10 megacycles, and if I'm foolish enough to want to use it at 200 megacycles, I know I'm going to be getting eddy current losses, among other kinds of losses, maybe dielectric losses. to my knowledge, on a primary coil of wire on a magnetic material, the only mechanism by which loss can take place would be to affect the power factor. In other words, what is the phase angle versus the voltage that I'm applying to that coil? If I'm using a network analyzer the right way, and I'm measuring phase angle, therefore I'm measuring power factor, and if I'm smart enough to know how many turns I've got, what cross-sectional area, and so on, isn't it possible for me to rate the loss tangent, so to speak, of that material at that crazy frequency? KC2QIQ, K2RIW?
I think you can, but I'm just, the thing that I'm right now I'm a little stuck on, but because I never really thought about it, is that, in other words, hysteresis loss inside the core, now does that reflect back to power factor? Yeah, I guess it would. It actually should, right? KC2QIQ.
Yeah, because the hysteresis loss is a nonlinear effect, you've got to come up with some kind of an average and all of the factors you measure. But does that really allow you to evaluate the area under the curve, which is really the loss factor that goes on with hysteresis materials? Maybe Howard's going to straighten us all out on this. KC2OJO, you've got it, Howard. K2RIW.
I don't think I can straighten you out, but I might be able to lead you to a very convenient reference that I found a couple of months ago. Basically, it's from the UK, and what it shows is a simple AC generator feeding some turns on your core, pick-off of some turns on the core, going into an integrator, and then using a two-axis oscilloscope, one for the excitation, basically the current through the primary, and one looking at the output of the integrator. And then the author takes you through looking at the scope and measuring the different parameters, and he derives just about everything. Let me drop one second. What he does is by measuring the hysteresis loop on the oscilloscope and looking at the angle and so forth, he derives all of the parameters that you'd like to know about the core at the operating frequency, including the hysteresis losses and the permeability. And he shows the permeability plotted as an example according to field strength and so forth. So let me just see. It's a kind of a long URL, but I can give you the URL. It's http://www.info.ee.surrey.ac.uk. Let me drop again. Followed by /workshop/advice/coils/BHC/KT/index.html. Probably you can work your way through the info.ee.surrey.ac.uk/workshop and so forth and get to the right spot. But it's very interesting because it's a very simple circuit diagram of how you can run the measurements and what I think is a very clear explanation that takes you right through all the formulas and lets you derive just about everything. Back to Ned.
KC2QIQ with one more comment.
Yeah, that sounds like a valuable one. What search word did you use through Google, for instance, to find that particular site, Howard? Then I'm going to go over to Glenn. Go ahead, Howard.
I'm rather embarrassed about that. It was so long ago, perhaps a couple months ago, I think. Wesley was probably talking about magnetics, and I got interested in it, then sometime, perhaps a few weeks later, I just started to browse, and I came across this particular, which seems very straightforward. You know, very often I think the problem is people either throw long formulas at you, or they throw simplified explanations that get you nowhere, and I thought this was a nice balance. But, you know, what's a nice balance for me might not be good for somebody else, but it's probably worth looking at. Back to Nat.
Okay, it definitely sounds like it's worth looking at. And before Wesley got us into the subject some months ago, I think it's pretty obvious that we all were reasonably ignorant, except for Glenn, on how magnetic materials work. We're slowly becoming educated. Go ahead, Glenn. Look what you guys have caused.
Magnetics are a lot of fun. They can also really drive you crazy, but it's always nice to work with the known classical, types of toroids, E-cores, and the like. When you start getting into really odd shapes, it really can become interesting. But just thinking about what you said about power factor again, and hysteresis loss. Now, the hysteresis loss is a real loss. That's an R, so it causes heating in the core. And power factor may not be the best way to do it. I mean, I don't think it's impossible to measure it that way, but I think the problem is that you would have to know what the excitation is in the B field, because the hysteresis loss is going to be dependent on frequency, wave shape, and the amplitude of B, how much magnetic flux you're creating at that point. So there's a lot of variables in that, so I don't think it's really a direct measurement, Nick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Question for Glenn.
Yeah, John, recognized. I'm reasonably sure that the power factor is definitely going to change as a function of amplitude of excitation. That really is the amount of the hysteresis curve that you're traversing. And as you get into the more and more nonlinear functions and you start increasing the amount of area in that hysteresis loop, power factor will give you a hint. I'm worried about the fact that power factor might be defined for a sinusoid of current and voltage, and you look for the phase shift between the two. In the case of a hysteresis loop of most magnetic materials, it really isn't a pure sine wave anymore. Therefore, the simple assumption of power factor can certainly break down. You got it, John.
Yes, Glenn, I'd like to digress for a moment. A few minutes ago, you were mentioning the toroid ferrite and the winding around it. Did I hear you right that because of the inadequate distribution of some materials, that if you were to wind, say, 10 turns on it and put it on an instrument to measure it, as you rotated those turns around the ferrite core, you would notice a difference in the readings? Am I correct?
Yeah, there'd be a difference in inductance, and the effect is actually called Valare effect, and what it really has to do with is how well the wire sits around the cross-sectional area of whatever the material is around that core. And, of course, like everything else, the core itself, even though it's the density of the magnetic material as it goes around is pretty uniform, but there again also the spacing of the wire between, the air around the inductor and how tight it is around the core and how well its permeance is, through the center of those turns is going to give you, some variations in the inductance. So by, winding the wires tight to the core and getting as many turns as reasonable, that you accurately know how many turns there are, will give you a better measurement, KC2QIQ.
Okay, very good. Back to you, Dick.
So let me go one step further with that. If I wound the 10-turn coil, so to speak, on some kind of a coil form and it's glued down, and I've wound this around my toroid, and I first locate that fixed mechanical arrangement coil, I locate it at the 12 o'clock point on the toroid, then I slide it to the 3 o'clock point, I slide it to the 6 o'clock point, I slide it to the 9 o'clock point. In that situation, am I likely to see differences on reasonably well manufactured toroid material? And if I had brand Z, would I see significant variation? Back to you, Glenn.
I think between brand A and brand B, more than likely not. But here again, depending on what material type and what the permeability is, like if you have a very high permeability, like something like 2500, just, you know, a really nice P-type ferrite material, you know, as you move it along, you might not see too much.